This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. GOP presidential candidate and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, on the tails of some big New Hampshire endorsements, thanked his supporters in Concord on Monday.
These folks are going to be helpful. I appreciate their help, appreciate their advice and their counsel and their direction on how to move and where to go. But in the end, the candidate's got to close the sale with the voters. And that's my job over the next 68 days or so. And that's exactly what I'm going to be trying to do.
The New Hampshire Task Force on Opioids took up more aspects of the drug abuse epidemic this week, including opiate prescription monitoring. Program manager of that system, Michelle Rico Jonas, told lawmakers on Tuesday that the tool will target prevention rather than treatment.
We're kind of stopping the new abuse of opiates. We're not going to do anything about people who are currently addicted to opiates and who may be progressing, but we are going to have an impact on people who will potentially begin a new pattern of abuse and or have that lead to addiction.
And the Kinder Morgan pipeline moved forward this week with its first required information session. Despite all the attention on other energy projects, fewer than 50 people turned out for the first meeting. Bob Runko, who lives along the proposed route in Hudson, wasn't optimistic that it could be stopped.
I'd like to see it stopped, but I just don't have high hopes that it will. Too much money already spent. This cart's way down the road.
Today on The Exchange, it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two reporters joining me for the full hour this morning. With me is Daniel Barrick. Dan is NHPR's senior editor for politics and public policy. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Dean.
And Jeff Feingold. Jeff is editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome back to The Exchange.
Great to be here, Dean.
And also joining me at the top of the show is Casey McDermott. Casey is an NHPR digital reporter covering politics, policy, and New Hampshire news. And Casey, thanks for sitting in with us.
Thank you.
Casey, let me turn to you first. You've been covering this legislative task force that was recently formed to deal with the drug crisis here in New Hampshire. Can you briefly remind us of the origins and objectives of this task force?
Sure. So this was convened in the last month to basically take a really concerted look at how, at the state level, policymakers can take some action to curb the effects of heroin and opioid abuse in New Hampshire. So they met last week just kind of and had a day-long session where they heard from a number of experts on lots of different fronts, from the law enforcement side to the medical side, people in recovery, just kind of, you know, laying the groundwork for the weeks ahead. So now this week they moved into a number of sessions where the lawmakers involved are kind of broken up into different groups that are looking at different aspects of the policy responses to this, and they're reviewing different proposals that might affect, funding for drug courts or funding for the prescription drug monitoring program, different approaches to criminal penalties related to fentanyl and other things, and just kind of trying to assess which ones might be able to be recommended for expedited review once the legislature returns in January.
So it's a broad mandate, but the goal here is to actually produce actionable legislation in January?
Yeah. So basically, they're looking to come up with a set of recommendations out of this task force that they can then take to the legislature and kind of fast track once the full body is back in session.
Right. And Governor Hassan had hoped to do this in the fall, but then they all decided that it made more sense to move it legislatively, particularly from the Republican perspective, to wait until January.
Yeah. So the task force kind of, you know, it serves the purpose of reviewing these proposals and kind of vetting them before they are fully enacted. But it also serves kind of a secondary purpose of educating the legislators who might not have been following this as closely or might not be as familiar with kind of the specific dynamics or the nuances of the heroin issues in New Hampshire. So, for example, like some legislators might not be familiar with the different types of recovery options that are in effect, what's working, what's not working. Some of the different, you know, specific issues that are affecting people at a community level. So that's been a lot of what's happening is just kind of catching them up to speed to what's already going on and what the scope of the problem is.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard a lot of talk about funding issues and concerns about how to pay for this. What's the latest on that?
So that's it looks like the proposals are kind of drawing from a few different sources. Some of them would, for example, there's a proposal to create kind of a law enforcement grant funding program that would provide more support for responses on, you know, a local community level. And that would tap into both general funds and also the highway fund and some other kind of dedicated funds. Most of them would use state funding, so the general fund.
Mm-hmm. And I'd heard something about, I think they were talking about spending maybe $12 million, but they want to wait and see how much money they're going to have at the end of the year. It could be a much larger amount.
Yeah. So Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley was cautious about taking any action, you know, right away on, especially on kind of the big ticket items. Mm-hmm. Now, he's proposing some stuff that would require the state to spend money. But I think his philosophy is that he wants to wait and kind of see where the state's finances are and have a better picture of where New Hampshire is at financially before they move forward with any of these big ticket items.
Yeah, I had seen a figure of possibly as much as $70 million or something that they're thinking, which would clearly change the calculus on funding this. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, sort of kind of the most high profile issues? For example, I've heard there's been this sort of new focus on fentanyl, which seems to be the one drug that is really surging in the state.
Yeah. So actually, if you look at the numbers, fentanyl has, in fact, surged in the last 2 years. It's been involved in more opioid-related deaths.
That's a pain med, I believe.
Yeah. Well, there's kind of the way that it's been described in these meetings is there's the fentanyl that you can be prescribed, and then there's this kind of analog fentanyl that's manufactured in kind of drug labs. And that's the thing that can be really dangerous because it can be very hard to distinguish when it's mixed in with other drugs. Often, people at the state drug lab and the police departments that are finding these, sometimes they're labeled as other drugs entirely. So the police officers, let alone the people who might think that they're getting, you know, heroin or some other drug, could actually be getting something that's laced with this very potent, very powerful drug. And it's leading to hundreds of fatalities in the state. And so what they're looking at doing, and this is a proposal that Senator Bradley has brought forward.
Right.
Is bringing the penalties for fentanyl distribution in line with those for heroin, because right now they're not equal.
Yeah, and that was, you know, we had heard, I think, that Governor Hassan wanted to move quickly on fentanyl. Now it sounds like Majority Leader Bradley is trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, this is one of a number of areas where there's actually a lot of bipartisan agreement between kind of Governor Hassan and the Republican leaders who are kind of leading their own charge on a response to this. There's also some agreement on stepping up funding for the prescription drug monitoring program. Both sides have been supportive of the idea of giving up to $100,000 to that program to help them kind of to set up technology upgrades that would make it more used at a wider level throughout the state, because right now it's kind of sporadic.
So we'll look for that in January in terms of legislation. So just one final question for you. What are you going to be looking for going forward into the holidays and then on into January?
So I think what I'll be looking for, they'll be back in session next week, the three committees looking at other proposals related to some of the stuff that we've already talked about, as well as some other proposals that haven't fully been vetted yet. So I'll be looking at kind of where the legislators are really targeting their focus and what are their priorities, because there are as many as kind of 24 different proposals that have been submitted. So it'll be I'll be watching for what they're really looking to prioritize and what they think they can make the most impact on at this point. And then they might be shelving some stuff to kind of take a more kind of cautious approach at some of the stuff that might be more complicated and require more vetting.
Mm-hmm. A lot of issues at play here, and it'll be interesting to see how this develops into January. Casey, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed on this.
Thank you.
That's Casey McDermott, NHPR's digital reporter. And let me bring in Dan Barrick and Jeff Feingold to talk about some of the other stories in the news this weekend. Gentlemen, let's turn to an interesting political and regulatory story dealing with the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline, which we also know as the Kinder Morgan Pipeline. A number of politicians in New Hampshire, even including a presidential candidate or two, have spoken out on the project. Dan, let me turn to you first. What's the latest on this?
Well, the latest, I mean, on sort of on two fronts. On the political front, as you alluded to, at this point, pretty much every top elected official in New Hampshire has come out opposing this project. And just to review, it's about a 70-mile pipeline that would run through the southwestern part of the state along the Massachusetts border. It would carry natural gas from Pennsylvania up into northern New England. Most of the opposition at this point has been in the local communities where residents have raised concerns about safety and aesthetics and environmental risks. But just in the last few days, we've seen Governor Haas and Senator Ayotte, Congresswoman Annie Custer, and Congressman Frank Ginta all raise serious concerns, or actually coming out in opposition to the pipeline until some of their questions can be answered. So that's a big sort of political shift in a short amount of time. On the actual, the other regulatory front, the pipeline developers have been holding a series of town hall meetings in some of the communities trying to answer questions and allay concerns and share information. And FERC, the Federal Energy Regulation Commission, which will be the body that will actually decide this, is continuing to gather information. So that's, while there's been a lot of talk about the politics of this, I mean, ultimately, this is a bureaucratic decision made by a bureaucracy in Washington, and that's really where this issue will be decided. So it's kind of unclear, while that body does account for local questions and concerns, it's really not – it's out of the hands of politics. Congress or governors can't veto this project. This is
interesting. So this doesn't go through the typical state site evaluation committee, Jeff? Does it?
I think it does go also through the state process as well.
That's the site evaluation.
But it's not a legislative.
Yeah, no, it's not a legislative. It is in the hands of regulatory bodies, as Dan said.
Yeah. Your thought on politics.
One of the things about it is, and also, as you said, Bernie Sanders also came out against it at the recent Jefferson Jackson Day dinner. It's interesting, though, that to me, at the same time, there's a parallel debate going on, certainly among people in the business community, about the need for more energy in the state. And they've been pushed, the BIA, the Business and Industry Association, has this effort called Energize NH, and they're kind of basically agnostic on what to do, but they want to say we need more energy in the state. And it's interesting that we have so many leading politicians, the top elected officials in the state basically, except Senator Shaheen is the only one who's still kind of on the fence about it, have opposed this, while at the same time, people in the business community are saying we desperately need this for the economic development, the continued economic development of the state.
Yeah, and Dan, as I was reading some of the opposition that came out from the various politicians, I was trying to see if there was any daylight between the lines between some of the candidates. Are they all saying politicians? Are they all saying absolutely not, or are some of them saying maybe on this?
It's a lot of we need more information. I'm opposed until we get more information, or until Kinder Morgan, the pipeline's proposed developer, can answer some more questions. A lot of framing around, I'm responding to the concerns of local communities, and since their concerns have not been heard, I can't support this until that's been resolved.
Yeah, and also, it's about, 71 miles? It goes through 17 southern New Hampshire communities. And from what I understand, the opposition to the pipeline is nowhere near as strong in the eastern communities as they are in the western, in the Keene area. And that's also very interesting that they've obviously found there's a need to actually circle the wagons on that, even though it's basically a handful of communities that are voicing the most opposition to this.
Well, and Dan, it sounds like there weren't a lot of people who turned out for their first information session. Yet, as we've seen with Northern Pass, these things still seem to manage to get bogged down. Although in the opening, we heard from a resident who felt like he was kind of helpless. So how does this play out?
This is a good question. I don't know. I mean, if you again, just returning to the politics, I mean, I think in some ways the fact that both Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan, who will be facing off in a Senate race next year, seem to be on the same page with this sort of takes it off the table. So there may be actually less political hay made of this in the next year. But, you know, Kinder Morgan, which is the developer, is a national energy company. They're very accomplished in getting projects through. Actually, this project was originally designed to go through Western Massachusetts. They rerouted it through Southern New Hampshire after opposition in both at the local and state level in that state. That doesn't seem to have reached a critical mass here in New Hampshire to force them to redraw the map. But they want to get this done, and I think their track record across the country shows that, you know, they're a serious player in this industry. So they're not going away easily, I don't think.
Jeff, what do you think is going to happen?
Dan raises a really good point about how it's basically taken off the table in a Senate race between Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan. I also think that the other issue is that I know that Governor Hassan has voiced opposition or questions about Northern Pass, and I'm trying to remember whether Senator Ayotte has as well, which would be very interesting because that, you know, that's in New Hampshire, that's like one of the prime issues is energy.
Right,
and it's taken off the table. What do we do?
Right, and so you have the legal avenues, yeah. But this political environment is almost probably more important. So we're going to be watching that develop. I have a feeling we're going to be talking about that for many weeks to come. Let's turn to another story here, and Dan, let me go to you first. Planned Parenthood has been in the news nationally with the clinic shooting in Colorado, but also making some news here in Claremont with a closed clinic reopening. What's going on there?
Yeah, there was an attack at a clinic, I believe by an axe-wielding young man quite a while ago. The clinic recently reopened. But of course, you know, the environment for Planned Parenthood has been so charged the last year, whether it's the videotapes that came out, the shooting in Colorado, efforts at the national level to defund Planned Parenthood. And even here in New Hampshire, with the executive council rejecting the contract. So there's, you know, it's really hard to disentangle Planned Parenthood as an health provider organization that suffered a crime in a small town in New Hampshire from Planned Parenthood, the national sort of political maelstrom. But at least within Claremont, that's, you know, things seem fairly, you know, for steady rudder there at this point. So.
Yeah, Jeff, how do you see that playing out in the state?
Yeah, I think that there is quite a bit of support for Planned Parenthood in New Hampshire historically. It hasn't been as much of a lightning rod.
Even with the furor over the funding,
there were attempts to do it, but there's a very strong support, I think, for certainly abortion rights in the general frame, saying, you know, basically it's an individual's choice. It's been proven time and again with the election of Senator Sheen, Governor Hassan, and other people. They've been trying to make that an issue, but it's usually an issue that's kind of reserved for the Republican primary in most cases. But, you know, it's still those videos that allege that Planned Parenthood was selling body parts, which later proved to be false. Those videos were not exactly complete journalism. I think that might have muddied the waters a little bit in New Hampshire. But in general, I don't think it's like it is in many other states where it's a much more of a hot button issue.
Dan, is that your sense in a well? Are we mainly hearing about it because of the presidential race?
There's some of that, but I mean, I do think the Planned Parenthood, I mean, you know, the executive council voted to reject funding for Planned Parenthood in New Hampshire a few months ago.
Majority Republican executive council, yeah.
That we're going to hear that in the governor's race. You know, two executive counselors are running for governor, Democrat Colin Van Ostern and Republican Chris Sununu, who are on opposite sides of that vote. Sununu described himself as pro-choice, but that's going to be an issue, I think, you're going to hear about. Just along the lines Jeff said, you know, generally speaking, New Hampshire has been a state where majority of voters have favored abortion rights, but both because of the national environment, how it's playing out at the presidential level and within Congress, but also there's a record here in the state of not too recently where actually policy was changed because of that. I think we're going to hear about that.
Yeah, no, and also raises a question also in the Senate race as well.
Right.
Because congressional races.
Yeah, and the congressional races, it will be an issue. But I don't know if that's a winner for the people who are opposing Planned Parenthood.
Right. So we need to take a quick break here, but we'll be back with a lot more conversation. We're going to talk about the First in the Nation primary, all the action there. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. I have two guests with me for the hour. Today, Dan Barrick, NHPR Senior Editor for Politics and Public Policy, and Jeff Feingold, Editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. And gentlemen, let's turn our attentions to the First in the Nation presidential primary. A lot of stuff going on among both Republicans and Democrats. But let's start with the Republicans. Probably the biggest story in the past week, both locally and nationally, was the union leaders' endorsement of Chris Christie for president. And Dan, let me start with you. It got tremendous coverage. Just initially, what was their reason or their rationale for choosing Christie over the others?
Well, in a nutshell, it was they looked at his record as a U.S. Attorney General and as a governor of a big state as the candidate who, in their words, would keep America safe. It seemed very much shaped by the recent events in Paris and elsewhere, ISIS attacks, that there's a seriousness to Chris Christie that's lacking from other front runners, that knows how to manage the nation's foreign affairs. It's interesting. I mean, you know, the union leader is still very much a behemoth in sort of establishment Republican politics in New Hampshire. Their track record in picking Republican presidential primary endorsements is less than perfect. They endorsed Newt Gingrich 4 years ago. Didn't seem to do much for him. But I think just the news, Chris Christie also, whether it's through coordination or just good luck, also happened to be in the state this week and happened to be rolling out a number of high-profile or at least well-known endorsements. Former House Speaker Donna Sitek, very respected Republican, endorsed him. The Plumbers, Renee and Dan Plummer, a well-known Seacoast businessman and woman, endorsed him. Excuse me. And, you know, I don't know if we're at that stage of the primary where, you know, the movement within the field starts to be a little bit more frantic and common, but at least on the trail, Christie seems to be enjoying a wind at his back that he's not been having for a while. And frankly, a lot of candidates outside of Donald Trump haven't really been seemed to be enjoying in New Hampshire for quite some time.
Yeah. Jeff?
Yeah, I have to say that it's interesting that, you know, you only picked Governor Christie to endorse. Obviously, there were a lot of choices this time around. But the thing that strikes me the most is that, you know, Governor Christie has been campaigning in New Hampshire the old-fashioned way. You know, holding town halls, talking to voters, meeting with voters, which I think is really interesting because, as you know, as we've seen in these many months now, that it's mostly, you know, staged events, and, you know, that many of the candidates are kind of staying away from meeting real voters, you know, not just their supporters.
Well, and this is one of the concerns you hear, that you have a Republican primary where the top couple of candidates not doing a lot of retail yeah. politics in New Hampshire.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was interesting that they chose to endorse him. But the other thing was that I guess this sort of set off a kind of a spat between the union leader and, I will say in full disclosure, a former paper that was an employer of mine, the Star-Ledger of Newark, New Jersey. Basically, Star-Ledger said in an editorial that in response to the union leader endorsement, that basically the union leader didn't know what it was talking about. They don't know about Christie's record in New Jersey. And then the union leader responded in turn that Star-Ledger was like a jilted ex-girlfriend or something, some kind of sexist remark like
and
that.
And then I believe Christie picked up on that. Yeah, and Christie
picked
repeating.
Up on it. And then the editorial board of the Star-Ledger said, well, no, there was no love in the first place.
Yeah, Dan, it was interesting. Joe McQuaid, the publisher of the Union Leader, was on television and a number of outlets, and I heard him say, we focused on the governors. What did he mean by that?
Well, I think there's a level of accomplishment and seriousness that they see within, you know, folks who've actually run a state, who've actually managed a government, managed a bureaucracy.
And I think, you know, you mentioned Joe McQuaid, the publisher, was out days after that talking about the endorsement and talking up Christine. I think you're going to see, I mean, the union leader has a record of, once they get behind a candidate, of hammering his or her opponents.
So getting the endorsements on, only half of the
right. Then
payoff,
you get
right?
Then you get the other, the anti-endorsements of the other candidates. And you know, and Jeff mentioned the kind of dogged campaign style that Chris Christie's been pursuing for much of the last year. A lot of it under the radar. You know, a lot of it when he'd been written off, and he's still coming up here doing three events a day up and down the state. And I think you saw that too, that kind of dogged campaigning of actual, you know, New Hampshire House members, county sheriffs. He's been rolling out these endorsements that show, you know, he has been doing that kind of old-fashioned shoe leather retail campaigning. I think the union leader was in part rewarding that with their endorsement, and I wonder if there is any kind of fading of the top of the, of these front runners who, as you said, Dean, have not been lavishing a lot of time and energy on the sure. state. Mm-hmm. If that kind of spade work that Chris Christie's been doing will be rewarded by the voters.
Well, that does remain to be seen. But I think Governor Christie, if he finishes, let's say, third or even fourth in a large field, I think that's a big boost to his campaign. You know, what he can do in South Carolina is another matter. But the other thing is that, you know, Nate Silver, the 538 website,
yes.
which is, you know, looks at every number possible in polls, I guess he found that there's an average of about 11% bump in the polling eventually, you know, between
typically or in this case, just
in New Hampshire, you know, between the union leader getting, you know, the endorsement and you get a bump. And that's really pretty significant. That would bring Christie up into a much, you know.
Dan, I did see a public policy poll that just came out that did have Christie moving up to 10%, fourth place.
Yeah, I think
it's going to pay dividends for him, you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, predictions in this year have been a dime a dozen and worth even less. So I don't know. I mean, the only constants really since July have been Donald Trump at the top of the field. We've seen Kasich come up and down. Rubio's enjoyed a little bit of a bump, but it's hard to know how solid any of that is. And that's why I say, I wonder if once people get closer to the voting and the polls go away and the actual ballots are cast, if a candidate like Christie, or even for that matter like a Kasich, who have put in a lot of on-the-ground time meeting voters face-to-face, talking to local officials and local connected Republicans who are the folks who, you know, might tell their neighbors, hey, you should vote for this Christie guy, if that's going to pay off in February.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that, you know, another aspect of this is that the media landscape has really changed so dramatically in the last 10 years or so. And the union leader endorsement used to be a lot. And it's not the same anymore. It's kind of just one of the voices in a gigantic media landscape that includes, you know, internet websites that are you know, international, that people get their information from. So whether this has that kind of a boost for the endorsed candidate remains to be seen.
So let's take a quick step back and look at the Republican field overall. Donald Trump continues to lead. Some say Ben Carson is fading. Cruz and Rubio seem to be solidifying their positions. And then we have this battle among the governors, Kasich, Bush and Christie, just below that, with Christie now at least in one poll in fourth place. So let me ask both of you, how do you see the field shaping up? What are you looking for over the next month or so?
My feeling is, I think that at some point the lower tier candidates, that I guess doesn't include Governor Christie right now anymore. It did a few days ago. I think that at some point it's going to dawn on them that to really make a dent in Donald Trump's lead, you know, his lead that's been months now, is that they're going to have to just kind of realize, you know, we got to get behind somebody else to really, if they're going to have any effect, because the billionaire seems to just be standing up there and nothing seems to be getting it.
The question is, who makes that call?
No,
nobody wants
exactly,
to be the right.
Exactly, but you know,
how do you get
but
people
I do
to drop
think
out?
If the endorsement of the union leader might be assigned to some other candidate, well, you know,
viability.
Similarly, we've been hearing these rumblings in the press for some time about the establishment donor class within the National Republican Party talking amongst themselves about what do we do about Donald Trump. Do we launch some mega, negative ad campaign against him? Do we all get behind some candidate? You've been reading this for months, and to no actual manifestation. I don't know if that's going to happen. If it does, that will certainly shake up the tenor of the race. It will
if nothing else, energize Donald Trump.
I was going to say, Trump almost seems to feed on that.
Right. It's interesting to see how negative ads work on Donald Trump.
Not as intended. I want to let our listeners know it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're in the middle of talking about the first in the nation presidential primary, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. I have two reporters with me in studio, Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, and Dan Barrick, NHPR senior editor for politics and public policy. So we've talked about the Republicans. Let's shift gears now and talk a little Democratic politics. And Dan, let me start with you. Last weekend was the big Jefferson Jackson dinner in Manchester. All the candidates spoke. It seemed like a real big party for Democrats. What happened?
Yeah, so it's the biggest annual fundraiser for the state party. They had about 1,500 Democrats from around the state come. And it's generally, I mean, you know, it's always a big deal. But obviously the JJ dinner right before the presidential primary is an even bigger deal. You know, it's generally good feelings all around. It's not a time for the candidates or their surrogates to attack each other. But all the three major candidates, O'Malley, Clinton, and Sanders, all spoke. Generally agreement on policy, a lot of talk about gun control, about abortion rights, or, you know, core Democratic
issues. Right.
There was some, you know, kind of veiled references, no out-and-out attacks among the candidates, but veiled references to qualifications. You know, Martin O'Malley said, I'm not a reformed socialist or a former Republican, referring to his two rivals. Bernie Sanders mentioned the 2002 Iraq war vote, his opposition to it as evidence of his foresight or stability. And you know, Clinton even saying, you know, I'm not running to make a point here, which I think is a veiled reference to Sanders and his talk of political revolution. Generally speaking, you know, it's a positive, upbeat night. And I think there was a lot of, you know, talking to folks who were there, including a couple of our reporters, you know, general good feeling among the crowd. You know, they're feeling like they've got a good feel. There's not the kind of sort of more tense fighting that you're seeing on the Republican side within this field. So,
but you don't see the deep divisions in the party right now that you do on the Republican side.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of folks saying that they feel they could support any of these candidates if it came down to it, whether in the primary or the general.
Yeah, there's a different tone to it than earlier this year when they had their convention and Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz spoke, who's also the head of the Democratic National Committee, and she was actually booed because people in the audience, you know, New Hampshire Democrats were calling for more debates in the process, and apparently there wasn't that kind of a feeling this time around.
And it sounds like they raised something like $250,000 for the party, which is a bonus. So let's take a look at the Democratic field here in New Hampshire. It seems to be very close. Where are we right now, Dan?
Well, we are where we've been for a while, which is Clinton and Sanders, according to most polls, are battling it out for the top. It seems like Sanders' rise has slowed a bit. And then O'Malley, further behind in third place, seems like he's picked up a little bit. I've seen around 8% or something like that with the departure of Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee. But, you know, the two candidates at the top are competing statewide. They're both raising a lot of money. They're both drawing big crowds. We just published a post based off of some numbers we've been collecting on looking at past primaries about, you know, the last couple primaries that have been contested Democratic primaries. 2004, which was mostly John Kerry and Howard Dean, and 2008 with Clinton and Obama. You see this real segmentation of the state. The more western part of the state tends to favor the liberal sort of anti-establishment candidate, and the eventual winner of the primary is a candidate who can scoop up a lot of the southeastern vote-rich towns there. If history is a guide, that will likely be the path here. The challenge for Sanders will be to break into some of those more blue-collar Democratic strongholds, the old mill towns, urban centers, where Clinton
does
was
well,
really strong in 2008. I mean, that's where the vast majority of her votes are. And you know, Sanders is running a statewide operation. He's got a big staff. He's campaigning statewide. So it's really hard to see where if there's going to be a break in that dynamic.
Yeah, Jeff.
It remains to be seen how Senator Sanders his ground game is going to be going there. I mean, he has a pretty impressive structure, but Hillary Clinton's campaign in New Hampshire is really strong. I mean, if you look at the people who supporting her, Senator Shaheen, Governor Hassan, we're talking about, you know, really, really people who really know a lot about New Hampshire politics, and have been very successful at it.
And also, I mean, on the ground, we saw this week where she got the endorsement of, I think, 7 New Hampshire mayors backing a new local infrastructure proposal she had put forward to put about 250.
This is a big proposal.
Yeah.
$275 billion
like in local infrastructure, so roads, bridges, even broadband access. And in the day that she announced it, you know, she had 7 New Hampshire mayors getting on a conference call saying that we endorse this and we endorse her candidacy. So yeah, both at the top, you know, the Shaheens and the Hassans, but also, you know, it shows both the kind of bread and butter campaign policy that she's able to put together. Yeah. And coordinate it to really touch local communities.
You know, you could really argue that, especially with this recent proposal of this infrastructure plan with a lot of money to be spent, that Senator Sanders's effect is really very noticeable, especially in New Hampshire on her campaign. Mm-hmm. He really has pushed her a little bit more to the left in terms of wanting to spend more money and all these kinds of things.
It doesn't feel like there are any kind of ideological
She just keeps moving. If he keeps moving to the left, she's going to follow him, and it's really interesting. I don't think I know that at some point she's going to have the instincts not to go as far to the left as Senator Sanders for the general election, because obviously they see the Democrats see, or at least the Clinton campaign would see that the closer to the middle she is in the end would be much more. There'll be much more daylight between her and whoever the eventual Republican nominee is, no matter who it is at this point.
Yeah, and Dan, the demographic support you described when I was up at Dartmouth years ago, we used to call that the Vermont effect. That you have Connecticut River Valley, Bill Bradley, Howard Dean, Bernie Sanders.
It's really interesting though if you think about it, because I know I've been living in that second district since I moved to New Hampshire, and it has changed so dramatically over the years.
Charlie Bass used to be the member of Congress.
It was Jim Cleveland. It was a reliably Judd Gregg. I mean, we're talking about a Republican in that seat for seemed like forever.
Yeah.
But it's just a different. It really reflects how the state has changed so much in the last 30 years.
So let me ask both of you before we go to break. What are you going to be looking for with the Democrats over the next month or two?
Well, I'll be looking to see what's going on with Martin O'Malley, because I think there he does have a message to send to voters.
And he's been here more than either of
these
candidates,
right? It's true. And if you we're looking at let's say Governor Christie or Governor Kasich, he's been doing it the old-fashioned way. And maybe it'll pay some dividends. I mean, I don't know.
It's 8%, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think in terms of just name recognition, he's got a really long way to go still. But he's been going through that long slog, and he doesn't seem to be giving up. I know he's here. He's going to be here for the primary itself, and it'd be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah,
I'll be interested to see if the tone, particularly between Clinton and Sanders, changes. I mean, it's been generally they've been pointing out differences and. But even, at the national debates, we saw, they would spar over issues, but the tone was rather polite, with Sanders saying, the American people are sick and tired of talking about.
I remember some of the testiness with Obama and Clinton in
'08. Yeah. And I don't know if we're going to see that on the campaign trail or on TV, if the Clinton campaign feels that Sanders needs to be dispatched or Sanders feels that there's an opportunity to take on Clinton and highlight some of these issues that Republicans have been making hay about.
It is interesting to say, because that the issue of the Iraq war is one of his big talking points in opposing Secretary Clinton, and
who voted in favor of it,
and she kind of glosses over that, well, that was just like one vote or whatever, her response is, but it's strong. It's a very important issue still for a lot of people. In the Democratic primary voters, because that's really something that's it was strong in 2008 when Barack Obama
was strong
in
2004.
In 2004, absolutely.
And Dan, real quick, the data that you mentioned, people can go to nhpr.org.
Yep, the maps are up there. We're developing the database. We'll be rolling that out through the course of the primary. But there's a whole set of maps that help you understand just basic voting trends in past presidential primaries and maybe give a sense of what might be happening next year.
Excellent. So hopefully listeners will check that out. We need to take one more break. But coming up, we have more to talk about, stories of the week here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can call in and join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Twitter or on Facebook. Gentlemen, a couple of other stories that are in the news today. Jeff, let's start with you. Your paper and at least one other, if not more, have reported on lawsuits that have been filed against New Hampshire sand and gravel companies dealing with runoff pollution. What's going on there?
It's interesting that what's happened is that the Conservation Law Foundation has filed a total of four suits against four sand and gravel companies, or aggregate companies as they're called in the trade. And their suits are all take the same tack, is that they're suing these companies for failure to file permits to discharge their wastewater or stormwater into rivers or tributaries.
So they're just ignoring the law?
So apparently they're saying that it's not quite clear if they're ignoring the law, but apparently that's what the Conservation Law Foundation seems to be suggesting. These companies are what they're doing is they're basically saying that we talked to one of the companies. And they say, you know, it's basically just a money grab by the Conservation Law Foundation. They found a technicality, basically, and they're suing. And then we have to settle or pay. One of the firms already has settled, and paying this. I think Conservation Law Foundation $95,000 in legal fees, and some other money to the Nature Conservancy. But what the Conservation Law Foundation is saying, that this is very serious business, dumping water into the river, into the water. I'm dumping waste into the riverways, and what they're saying is it can't be ignored. This paperwork, it's there for a reason, and if it's not done, the EPA is not going to know what is going into the rivers if they need to clean it up later on, or need to know, you know, maybe we need to stop this or put more limits on these kind of dumpings.
Oh, go ahead.
No, so I was just going to say that, you know, it's a typical. Basically, I think in one way it's the Conservation Law Foundation saying, what's the state doing? Why aren't they regulating these things? Why is the Conservation Law Foundation have to file suits to make sure that these companies are filing their permits?
So I don't want to get too technical, but so this sounds like this is a standard process of manufacturing, or is there some allegation that they overstepping their bounds?
Well, I don't think it's an allegation that they're overstepping their bounds. I think basically what it is that you need to file paperwork to get a permit to do this. And the Conservation Law Foundation is alleging that they have not done this, and the Conservation Law Foundation says basically they need to do it if they want to do it. Just follow the rules.
And what has been the reaction from the state?
State apparently we have not gotten a reaction from the state, but we did have. I said we had a reaction from one of the sand and gravel companies. We contacted the others, and they didn't want to talk to us. But you know, the sand and gravel company that we did talk to said, you know, this is just. They just finally a technicality. You know, they're going after us for, you know, I'm just, you know, just a little guy, and they're going after us and that kind of stuff.
But this fund is a private entity.
The Conservation Law Foundation, absolutely. It's very well known here in these parts. They've taken action in a lot of things, and basically, what the person we talked to at the Conservation Law Foundation said, you know, we're just. I'm putting words in it. You know, we're fed up with this. These rules exist for a reason.
Right. So it'd be interesting to see if the state does get involved, and we'll certainly be watching.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see
how this develops. Another story that's been making news on and off in recent weeks is the Balsams redevelopment up in the North Country. And Dan, let me turn to you on this. There's been some movement on this project recently. What's the status here?
So the Balsams is one of those iconic grand hotels up in Dixville Notch in New Hampshire. That's had some financial. It's actually been closed for a few years. Since 2011, but there's been new movement, new investors, Les Otten looking to turn into a year-round resort destination. Coos County Planning Board recently approved his plans to do so. So, I mean, on paper, these are pretty ambitious plans. You know, you're talking like a golf course and skiing, and it would mean a lot for the region. I mean, you go that far north, there's a big hotel like that is really an anchor employer, and especially for a region that's been suffering economically for quite some time. You know, there's also just the politics of it. You know, everyone knows Dixville Notch is traditionally that's been the first town in New Hampshire to vote And for years, it was in the ballroom of the Ballsons, where the first, you know, you'd have TV cameras from around the country there to record.
Yeah, it's
the
a pretty
first...
neat place. Yeah. Up in there. Yep.
So I think there's a lot of nostalgia and just kind of cultural feeling for the for that institution in the state. Whether I mean the investors are really trying to go against the tide, though. I mean, this notion of a grand hotel that far north in New Hampshire. I mean, in some ways, that era is sort of past. You know, the
great hotels,
the grand hotels. But you know, the investors are promising to sink a lot of money into it. There's a lot of local support. You know, just to kind of revitalize that site and that part of the state. So you know, there are a lot of people rooting for it.
Yeah, yeah. It's really essential. It's become an essential thing up in the up in that part of the Coos County because you know the jobs are just go. There's no jobs. There's you know it's a very very it's very they're really on a really stretched economically up there. And this they've been looking at this this proposal by Les Otten as some kind of real sign that there's life in the economy up there. Yeah. And I think. You know, not just in terms of the jobs, but in terms of the investment, because it would be a several hundred million dollar investment. It would take decades to build.
Over many years. Right. Some of it is sort of an initial approval issue, but others is sort of a conceptual plan going out 10 years.
Getting the investors and getting the people to put money in. But, you know, we've done many stories on this in the Business Review. And, you know, Les Otten had a lot of success building these big ski areas. And this one, he says he wants to make it the biggest ski resort in the East, which that's saying a lot, and that's going to take a lot of money, but it's also going to be a lot residential, and he wants to build a performing arts center and all this stuff it sounds great. I mean, and if it works, you know, that would be fantastic, but it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of money to do it.
And Dan, so what's the initial timeline here? Some initial approvals and construction, do you know?
Yeah, I think sometime in 2016 is the initial sort of phase one. And then, as Jeff said, you know, you're talking many years to develop all both the infrastructure, the residential units, and just the, you know, just kind of the geological work construct these new.
The interesting thing is, though, when you talk about going up north, you know, there's a similar kind of huge development, actually, in much later stages, over at Jay Peak, which is also in very far north in Vermont, and that seems to have been very successful. One of the ways they done it was to get this financing that allows foreign investors to invest in your project. You know, wealthy foreign investors, and in return, they get a green card, which is some kind of like you know, like a parting gift. So I don't know.
I want to let our listeners know it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can still join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. I've been talking with two reporters today, Dan Barrick, NHPR senior editor for politics and policy, and Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. And Jeff, let me come back to you to ask you a little bit about the reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank by Congress. And what is this about and how does it affect New Hampshire?
Well, actually, it's part of this finally. They've been waiting for the Export-Import Bank to be reauthorized since June 30th. And they've been waiting a lot longer to have a multi-year highway transportation bill, you know, funding, which now is going to be a five-year, I think it's almost about $300 billion
investment.
Members
of Congress used to love transportation bills, but not anymore.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
It's taking years.
But they reached this compromise on this bill for the transportation, and the Export-Import Bank supporters said, well, let's tack the Export-Import Bank reauthorization on here, and it made its way through. The Export-Import Bank has become something of an issue in New Hampshire. There's quite a few companies that use it, you know, not only the big ones, like nationally, you know, I notice they refer to Boeing and General Electric using it, but also a lot of smaller companies in New Hampshire have used it and continue to use it because, you know, exports are a major, major, it's the lifeblood of a manufacturer in New Hampshire nowadays. They also, I actually, one of the things that happened after the Export-Import Bank reauthorization failed back in the summer, GE, which has a major aviation division here, plant here in Hooksett, they decided that they weren't going to be building some kind of they weren't going to be doing their work in the United States, that they were going to open up something overseas because they get the subsidies in
because
that.
Because of the bank
not being there. And they did that a couple of times, and there were some other high-profile companies doing the same kind of thing. And I think the pressure finally got to the opponents on this. that at least they just didn't go full throttle in opposing the reauthorization of the bank. They did put some limits on it. They took some of its authorization money down to like from $140 billion to $135 billion.
Yeah.
And their funding mechanism is a little weird on it. But the Export-Import Bank, from the reporting we've done, is it doesn't lose money. It makes money. And it, you know, the opposition just seemed to be more ideological than anything else.
So a sense of relief from the New Hampshire business community?
This had just happened, but I would think that the manufacturers we spoke to are very much relieved because they used it to basically do business overseas.
Right, right. One final story today, and Dan, I'm going to turn to you. Got some national attention. The owner of a water park in Candia, right outside of Manchester, chained himself to the big slide after the park was closed for financial and other reasons. But there's been some resolution to that. I believe he's no longer chained to the slide. What happened?
Right. He's no longer chained to the slide, which is good news, especially this time of year. This is the Liquid Planet Water Park in Candia. The owner, Kevin Dumont, had run into both some financial problems, had racked up more than $1 million in loans against the park, as well as some regulatory problems, actually been shut down or cited for health issues with the park, was seeking investors to help stave off foreclosure and to try and rally attention to his cause. A few weeks ago, he actually chained himself to the top of one of the water slides, which certainly got attention. I'm not sure it was the kind of move that would attract people looking to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars into a park. He came down recently, just right on the eve of the actual auction, because his doctor said that he'd actually come down with pneumonia because, not surprisingly, it can be kind of bad for your health to be at the top of a water slide in the middle of the night in November in New Hampshire. The park was auctioned off for about $1 million, a little less than $1 million, this week to the owners of Whale's Tail, much better, well-known.
Further north.
Yeah, further in Lincoln and much, I think more of a tourist attraction type park. So the park will likely remain, I'd assume, but Mr. Dumont is hopefully somewhere getting warm and taking some antibiotics.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, it just shows, the difficulty it is in running a small business, which is what this is. And, he gave it his best shot, and he just couldn't do it. And and it's obviously a seasonal business, so you need to have some deep pockets to be able to withstand that kind of.
Well, it's fascinating to me the way that a lot of times you hear about these sorts of attempts to raise funds, and increasingly it's just you throw something up on the web. You want to GoFundMe or one of these other means of kind of just getting money quickly and increasing visibility.
But he wasn't looking for a couple of bucks; he was looking for a lot of money.
$1.5 million.
So he was looking for $1.5 million, and it sold for $950 or something like that.
Yeah,
so.
I mean the bank probably just said enough's enough, or the mortgage holder, whoever the mortgage holder was.
Yeah, well, I'm sure people are relieved that he is no longer chained up there.
Although
that's kind of a pretty big setup up there, but still, nonetheless, you're pretty up high and got the elements. So good to have that resolved. We are winding down here, and as is tradition, I want to turn to both of you and ask you kind of what are you going to be looking at over the next week or so? We've got a couple minutes to talk here.
Yeah, so I was just going to say that one of the things we're going to be doing is really looking a little more closely at this Kinder Morgan pipeline proposal. One of the most interesting aspects of this is that the proponents of the pipeline say that we need the gas for to lower electricity rates, and we're going to look at is that so? Then are these gas fired plants, are they buying contracts through Kinder Morgan? Have they signed deals for long term contracts to say, well, we'll take this gas, because there's going to be a lot of cubic feet of gas going through that thing, and that would be what would lower the rates or at least make the rates stable. Because there'd be a uniform supply.
Right. And one of the concerns here, I think, which is the same that we've heard for Northern Pass, is that it's not really for New Hampshire. It's just we're sort of a conduit to get the energy somewhere else.
And Kinder Morgan insists that's not so, because they have some contracts. But the key contracts in terms of in affecting our electricity would be whether these natural gas-fired power plants that are dotted all around the state, are they taking, are they signing up to buy some of this gas? And we'll look into that.
Yeah, and I thought I read that that they're predicting there actually will be sufficient fuel this winter. That
yes.
there won't actually be a bottleneck. So this is sort of really kind of going forward. Really.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also fed into the narrative of the opponents of this pipeline, saying, "Well, look, we have enough energy this year, and it's not expensive. It's going to be much cheaper if you look at if you've been paying your oil or gas bill, propane bill this year. It's lower, but the point is, in terms of electricity." Yeah. That, you know, New Hampshire relies so much on natural gas for its electricity. That's why it's essential that we have that's why proponents of the pipeline say it's essential that we have a steady, bigger supply of natural gas. So we would have that. So we don't have those fluctuations that we had a couple of years back in terms of having not enough gas. And, you know, the rates went sky high, as anyone who could remember, you know, from their electric bills went crazy that year.
Right. And the rap is not that there's not enough fuel. It's just we can't get it into
the state.
We can't
get it here. You know, the pipeline's just not big enough to bring it in. And we're at the end of the pipeline. That's why they're building this. They want to build this pipeline.
It'd be interesting to see how the dynamic that all the questions that Jeff just outlined. So we talked about how Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan have both expressed their view on the pipeline. The three main contenders for the governor's race so far, as far as I'm aware, have not made public statements on it. Mark Connelly and Colin Van Olsen are on the Democratic side and Chris Sununu. And that this issue you're talking about, the cost of energy and the impact on the business community, would tend to be an issue that the next governor would tend to focus on. Yeah. You know, they would be much more in the face of the business community, or the business community would be lobbying this issue. So
New Hampshire has very, very high electric rates, and that's one of the.
And Dan, real quick, I want to give you a chance. Anything?
This Republican field this year just continues to baffle me. So we'll see. You know, just how it's being shaped by outside news, how it's being shaped by individual campaign styles. We'll see where Chris Christie goes and who's next after that.
And NHPR has a whole group of reporters covering this from head to toe, so I think lots more to come there. We are out of time, unfortunately. So much going on, but we'll be back next Friday to talk about it again. I'd like to thank my guests for joining us this morning. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dean.
That's Daniel Barrick. He's NHPR Senior Editor for Politics and Public Policy. And Jeff, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Great to be here, Dean.
That's Jeff Feingold. He's editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Thanks also to NHPR digital reporter Casey McDermott. She joined us earlier in the show. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski Larson. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Hallie Loft. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.